Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
All right. Hit the music, Sam. We're sitting here twiddling our thumbs, yo. You shaved. Look at that. You look like you're 12 years old.
Aww.
Wow.
You're so nice to notice.
12 years old with like a stubbly thing. Anyway.
Oh, hello, everyone. I'm Molly Wood.
I'm Kara Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, our grooming episode. No, I'm just kidding. This is a podcast where we make each other smarter about tech, the economy, and culture. And one of the questions we like to ask on this program from time to time, and actually a lot now that I think about it in all seriousness, is whether capitalism is working for us as people, for the economy, and for, people in it. Also, though, the environment and companies and communities and everybody, and honestly, kind of a toss-up.
I have to say, I think we should take a little credit for the fact that we've been asking this question for as long as we have on the podcast, almost since the beginning.
Almost 150 episodes, by the way. Oh, Sam sent me the
look
note.
Look at us. I know. We got to think of a milestone. Email us if you have any ideas for what we can do for our 150th anniversary.
The sesquicentennial of this program.
Oh, come on.
Come on. My words are my life.
So
that's
what we're going to do is, I've already figured out what we're going to do for the episode, which is take a bunch of tequila shots and try to say sesquicentennial a whole bunch of times.
Yes.
This is going to be amazing. anyway, it turns out that this conversation about capitalism has become a thing.
In the
presidential campaigns, across governments and pretty much everywhere. And so we are now at a moment where we have this economy that depends so much on, in some ways, extraction. There's the idea of what inequality is doing. And there are conversations about, okay, how can we fix this? Mm-hmm. And how can we fix this in a way that businesses will be on board with?
And you've heard this on Marketplace for Reels. We did a whole series on this. The idea of shareholder value, or what is sometimes called shareholder primacy. The idea, thank you, Milton Friedman of the University of Chicago back like 40 years ago. The idea that a company in this economy has no greater purpose than to return value to its investors, to its shareholders. That is the biggest thing companies can do. And 40 years, 50 years on, that is starting to look a little different.
Or put differently, in the words of Kai Rizdahl, capitalism doesn't care if you live or die.
Right. That's right.
However, it turns out that capitalism may be starting to realize that if we all die, there will be no one to buy the stuff. So for the first time, there are people in the world of corporate governance who are questioning this idea. I would not say for the first time. I would say for the first time since we sort of really shifted our thinking to prioritize shareholder value. Exactly. And now there is some traction on this idea and some new buzzwords floating around, such as stakeholder capitalism, the idea that instead of making shareholders rich, there are lots of stakeholders who need to benefit from the activities of your corporation.
Yeah. And this came up actually in no less a place than the World Economic Forum in Davos last month. A lot of people were talking about this idea of responsible investing and companies returning things to society writ large. Anyway, that is what we're going to talk about today. And we're going to talk about it with Jerry Davis. He's the Associate Dean for Business and Impact at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. Jerry, thanks for coming on.
Hey, my pleasure, Kai. Hey, Molly.
Hey, how are you?
I literally gave a speech at the Ross School of Business, and all I got was a lousy T-shirt. I'm just saying that.
Send you a coffee mug.
There you go.
I know. I think that was just a naked plea for swag.
That's what happened
there.
That's right.
Yeah, we got the hookup.
So let me just start with your job description, Associate Dean for Business. We get impact. Discuss.
You read my mind.
Yeah. As far as I know, I'm the only person on this earth that holds a job title like that. And the dean created it because the thought was business schools need to be a lot more proactive, as we say in business schools, in taking on the issues of social impact of business and trying to think through how do we point business in a more positive direction, use its forces for good and not for less good. So it's about sort of the curriculum, the research we do, how do we translate our ideas into public policy and what corporations do.
It feels like your title alone is evidence that this conversation is starting to experience an uptick, right? How long have you had this title, and do you think it's spreading?
It is 3 years. I have yet to see another business school adopt the title Associate Dean for Business Plus Impact, but there are a handful of other schools that are taking this on. Wharton also has a Dean for Impact. So I think there is definitely a tendency toward that, and you're seeing it a lot in the millennial students, that they are a lot more forthright about expecting business to do better.
Yeah, so millennial students, yay, but what about their elders, as it were, who the people who are running the companies who have to make these fundamental decisions about the focus of their value proposition?
Yeah, I think one thing to appreciate is just how unusual the idea that corporations exist to create shareholder value is. It was not like this forever. It certainly wasn't like this in 1950 or 1970 or even 1980. This is an idea that took a while to take hold. And once you have people being compensated based on share price, mm-hmm. particularly CEOs and other executives, it tends to become a bit self-perpetuating.
So what is the what's the push now? What is stakeholder capitalism? What does it mean? What are, you know, is it just a buzzword among many that sort of get mm-hmm. at this central ethos?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a rising sort of concern that capitalism is not serving everyone, as you said earlier, all the people, you know, or the environment. We're seeing rising inequality. And so I think there's a much bigger press by the broad public to take on the excesses of capitalism. And I would say the popularity of Bernie Sanders' campaign, Elizabeth Warren's campaign, demonstrates that there's definitely a strong public opinion that business needs to do better. So the notion of stakeholder capitalism is that corporations don't exist just for shareholders, that they exist in a community, that they have obligations to their employees, to the people that live in their communities, to their suppliers, to their customers, that basically they need to be good citizens and not purely focused on creating shareholder value. It's a pretty old idea. It only seems radical relative to what's come before, that notion of shareholder capitalism.
So we're seeing from people like Larry Fink at BlackRock, the big money manager, $7 trillion something dollars assets under management, came out, you know, a month or so ago and said, hey, listen, people in whom we invest, you got to start thinking along the lines of stakeholder return. We're also seeing it from the Business Roundtable. They came out a number of months ago with that new definition of what a company is in this economy, what a corporation is. What's the forcing mechanism, though, right? I mean, they're talking a good game, but show me the money, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone's going to make a difference in this conversation, I think it's going to be the giant index funds, BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street. Between the three of them, they own 21% of the S&P 500. Wow. So for almost any company you can name, Vanguard is its biggest shareholder. So when you have that kind of heft, if those three say, look, we want to see this corporation taking on other stakeholders, that can really make a difference because they hold the votes that are going to determine, you know, who's on the board of directors.
Well, so how long are we going to wait to see these changes happening, right? Because Vanguard could come out tomorrow with a statement that says just change your board of directors tomorrow. did I miss that press announcement?
They have not done that quite yet. But I think Larry Fink's letters are really significant. We'd never seen anything like that before. And what's important to know about index funds is they are universal permanent investors. Mm-hmm. So BlackRock, when they're running an index fund, they're invested forever. As long as money flows into that index fund, they're mm-hmm. going to own all of the companies listed in that index, and they're never going to sell. So they have essentially an eternal time frame for those companies. They have the longest term interest in all of capitalism. And they also own every company in the index, regardless of what the industry is. And so they have a much more sort of broad perspective than sort of an actively managed fund that only owns a handful of equities or a hedge fund. They've really got the long-term interests of the capitalist system at heart. And so they can afford to create pressures on companies to take a longer-term perspective. And I feel like Larry Fink's letters have been getting a bit more assertive over time. They're not just be nice to your sister. They really do have some teeth to them.
Let's go back to this idea of impact, though, because, you know, where I live in Silicon Valley, when you talk about impact investing, you're often saying that your investing will be concessionary. And so I guess what I'm getting
at is... What does that mean, concessionary?
It means you intend to not make as much money.
Oh, okay.
You will concede some returns in favor of impactful investing. And so I wonder, this is a long-winded way of saying, like, what's the business case? Are you going to make, you know, are businesses worried they're going to make less
flowers,
money?
But right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so I would say the evidence is not consistent with the idea that you have to lose money or take a hit by investing for impact. I mean, if anything, I would have thought oil companies are the best investment in history. You know, if you look at the, look at the Dow Jones Index, the only ones that have been there since the 30s are Exxon and, you know, whatever the other two oil companies are. So you'd think they would last forever, but they have not had great returns over the last couple of years. So it could be that we're reaching this kind of turning point. If investors say, wait, climate change is real and it's going to be costly, then it's possible to imagine that the more sort of climate-focused companies, the ones that are more thinking about their impact, will actually be a better investment. Haven't seen that just yet, but I would not write that off. And I basically would dispute the premise that, you're going to lose money by being an impact investor, that you're going to take a big hit.
Right, because there's upside to be had in just, for instance, climate change investing, right? But let me turn this just for a second, because when we talk about, you know, sustainable investing, the default is climate change. But also there are social impacts to be had, right? There are, you know, poverty alleviation, there are social safety net things. I mean, there are other implications that come with not being a rapacious American company.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There are a lot of things that you can focus on. If you looked at something like what does it take to be a B corporation, there's a whole lot of dimensions you can focus on to be a better citizen. And the expectation is not that every company is going to be superb on every dimension. A lot of companies want to choose a major. They're going to say, I'm going to focus on education or access to healthcare. But we don't expect them necessarily to be saints across all dimensions, but we want them to know what the dimensions are.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, though, there clearly some big companies are getting this. Certainly there is consumer pressure. What's it going to take to get us to a tipping point? Because I have to assume there are just as many companies saying, no, thank you. Shareholder value is working fine for us.
Yeah.
They're not saying it out loud, though.
Right. They're not saying it out loud, but they may still be. I guess we have a word in our prep, woke washing, which is not something I wish I had said out loud. And yet, here we are. Like, at what point, you know, when do we know that a company is sincere?
How are we going to know, right?
In its desire? What are the metrics for success here?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly the right question to ask. And I think the answer is that there's a lot more transparency about what companies are up to than there used to be. So what's it like to work at, you know, Hewlett-Packard, let's say? I have no idea. I can't, you know, the people that come and recruit at my school, I'm not sure what they're going to tell me. But now we've got Glassdoor, and now we've got anonymous ways for employees to post, here's what it's like to work at this company. And so once it becomes that transparent, that opens up a whole lot of possibilities. So what is this company's supply chain like? When activists decide to drill down on, say, Nestle to find out where's their cat food come from, and they discover that there's slavery in the supply chain, they're going to make that public. So it is very difficult for companies to just put up a wall or put up a veil so that no one knows what's going on. So I think because there's a lot more transparency about what companies are up to, it's a lot harder to be a successful hypocrite. You can't say, I'm out there to change the world. I'm making the world a better place through X, Y, and Z.
Right.
Because it's just too easy for someone to publicize, yeah, but wait a minute. We saw a super interesting instance of this after the Parkland shooting in February 2018. There's a website that posted the name of about three dozen companies and said, hey, these companies all have special deals for NRA members to give them discounts. Maybe we should be boycotting them. Within 48 hours, two dozen of those companies had cut their ties to the NRA, including Delta Airlines, which actually got a threatened loss of a tax cut from the legislature of Georgia. So the idea that a threatened boycott leads to companies changing their policies within 48 hours, we've never seen that before.
What do your brand new, shiny, minted MBAs who are going out into the world say? What are they looking for?
Mm-hmm.
So they want to know, am I going to be able to have a social impact in this job? Not everybody. So some people say, how much money am I going to make? How quickly am I going to move up? You know, what's the expense account like? But an awful lot of our students say, well, tell me, are you in a LEED certified headquarters? Can I do work with, you know, meaningful nonprofit organizations. If I get a client that I don't want to work with, can I skip out on that?
Ooh.
Yeah. Huh. So you're seeing a lot more millennials who really care about what kind of work they're going to be doing. And honestly, if you're a company that's trying to hire 1,000 business students, you need to be attentive to that. So in some sense, I mean, employees identify with their companies a lot more than customers do. The first thing we think of in changing companies is, let's have a boycott. Well, they don't always work that well. A lot of them backfire. The companies that changed what they did in response to that threatened boycott because of the NRA ties, that did not work out well for everyone. I mean, it definitely can raise sort of people with other opinions about that. But the employees that work for you, their opinions are the ones that really count because they have to show up at work every day to get the work done. And they're really identified with that company. If you go home for Thanksgiving and say, hey, I'm working for insert evildoer company name here, you know, they're going to get called on that. So my daughter goes to Stanford, which I probably shouldn't say on a podcast.
Well, especially because you're at Michigan. What's that about?
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Could have gotten tuition probably at Michigan, but no.
All right,
let's
we'll
give
delete
Stanford $75,000.
I know a young person who goes to Stanford and says, if your friends are recruiting at Facebook, you might make fun of them.
Yeah.
But if they're recruiting at, you know, insert evildoer company name here, you're not going to have friends and you're not going to get a date. So there really is some element of social pressure around sort of companies and what they do. And you're just seeing a lot more activism, particularly in the tech sector. You remember that November 2018 walkout by 20,000 Google employees. That is no joke. I mean, if Google can't keep their workers on side, that's going to be tough. And it's not just them. It's Amazon, it's Microsoft, Salesforce, you know, name the company.
Sure.
And you're seeing this level of employee activism that makes companies a lot more attentive to what they're doing. And so companies have some built-in pressures today that they really didn't 10 years ago.
Jerry Davis, he is the Associate Dean for Business and Impact at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. Yet another step in our understanding of capitalism and how it works in this economy, or maybe doesn't. Jerry, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks to you, Kai and Molly.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Is it working? Is it not working? What do you think? I don't know.
I know. Tell us. I don't know. I mean, listen, you know I'm pro-awareness.
Man, what am I, anti-awareness?
For an action-oriented person, which I can be, I still believe that the sort of like ongoing power of the continued conversation
does. Look, I think that's totally right.
And if
you think about the fact that in the 150-ish episodes that we've done, we've talked about it 10 times, 15 times, right? Probably close to 10% of the time, right?
And even when we're not talking about it, we're talking about it.
Yeah,
you know, I was thinking about our episode on veganism. And how much of a through line there was about how ultimately it comes back to capitalism. And we got a tweet, and I think this is actually worth acknowledging. We got a tweet that basically said, I'm getting really tired of how you guys and also people on the far left say capitalism like it is a bad word. And I think that's actually a fair thing to acknowledge because I think what we're talking about is sort of like unregulated capitalism, unrestricted capitalism. Anything with all of the brakes taken off is a dangerous speeding train car.
Look, capitalism puts food on my kitchen table, right?
Yep.
So it's
it gives people opportunity.
Right.
It builds
but
the greatest businesses
in
the world, but it has to to have rules.
Right.
Everything has to have rules or it grows out of control. I mean, that's like a law of nature. Without constraints, anything with unchecked growth will kill you. And that's where we are now. But anyway,
ladies and gentlemen, Molly Wood. Anyway, send us an email, send us a voice memo, take your pick. Make me smart at marketplace.org. And we'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
What do we do now?
We just wait. We just wait, and then stuff happens in my ears, and then I start talking like right now. There we go.
It's time for the news fix. So when I'm in my studio and then the music stops and then I say welcome back, is it like 2 minutes late?
Yeah, kind of. It's like forever. I'm sitting here, I'm knitting a sweater, and then finally you're on it. Yeah. I'm like, oh, look, she's here.
Fun facts about Kai, guys. Knits a sweater during almost every episode. The office is just lousy with him.
That's right. Okay. So I'm going to go first because we're going to do something a little meta today.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
I just saw that.
Own it. Own it. I think it's first of all, I think it's extremely topical. Right. And second of all, it lets me give a shout out to my friend Molly Wood because she wrote a cool piece, which is really interesting and thought provoking. Go.
I appreciate that. Yeah. I like a lot. Yeah. And I am actually delighted because it was one of those things I lobbed out into the world and was like, I'm not sure this is a thing.
No, it's a thing.
But it might be. Anyway, I wrote. So you may not know that I write a monthly-ish column for our friends over at Wired. Boy, they're so patient with me. Anyway, this week on Monday, I published a piece about the idea of cloud neutrality, because what I am discovering is that a lot of people don't totally understand what we mean when we say cloud. Like, all your stuff is in the cloud. And cloud has essentially become shorthand for internet.
That's why I put it up there, because the vernacular has become that thing. So anyway.
And in fact, the cloud version of the internet is basically what runs the digital economy. Mm-hmm. So, but the cloud is a whole series of computers and incredibly expensive data centers. It's an entire global physical infrastructure, like a global interstate system, that is built, owned, and completely controlled by maybe five companies. And the biggest three are the ones you know, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft. And like, they're incubating and hosting their competition. Yeah. Amazon's the one that started this. They would give like free, the way the cloud works, if you're a business or, an app provider, is that you basically rent storage space and computing power that you can't necessarily afford. You can't buy a whole bunch of servers, and you can't afford the like insane temperature controlled room with the bulletproof doors to host all those servers and keep all of your stuff running. So you rent that. And Amazon started it, and they would say, if you're a startup and you want to develop an app, you can have space for free.
Right.
And now they host all of Netflix is streaming, and they have a competing service. And like, as soon as these guys figure out how to make money some other way, that's a problem.
I just think we all need to be ready for the day when Amazon and all the rest of them say, it's our internet now.
Somebody,
and that's the point of Molly's piece. So
I
commend it to you. It's in Wired online this weekish, a couple of days ago. Check it out. It's really interesting.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, you bet.
You're great.
I'm going to keep going because I have another one that's really topical. So Ruth Bader Ginsburg was at Georgetown the other day, and she was asked about the Equal Rights Amendment. And God bless her, she's 85 years old, and she, of course, can say whatever she wants, but sometimes she ought not. Number one, back in the 2016 campaign when she was talking about Donald Trump and that entire episode where she said derogatory things about the candidate and later had to apologize. She said the other day that she thinks the Equal Rights Amendment supporters ought to start over. And remember, we did a whole episode on this and how they now have 38 states, but there's a whole lot of back and forth about the specifics of how it was passed and rescissions of passage and all that jazz. I just think it's really unfortunate that she decided to weigh in on this because there's a case that's pending that's going to wind up in the Supreme Court. And she has already talked about it. And I just think that's not great.
As in now she's going to have to recuse herself most
likely? I don't know. Well, look, they get to recuse themselves or not. See also Justice Scalia whenever they want. But it would have been better had she not.
Interesting.
I think.
So this is a process concern that you have here.
Yes.
Yeah.
And look, I share that concern, right? Because the very last thing you want is the ERA going into the Constitution with an asterisk on it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Or with one fewer vote.
Or yeah, or
for
whatever.
It. Not so, that it's a vote, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, so I think that's interesting subject. It's a follow-up on a thing we did, and so I thought it was worthwhile.
That's a real interesting take.
Yep. That's me, king of the interesting takes.
That's true. So true. Oh, Ruth Bader. Yeah. But you're so cool.
Yeah. Oh, look, I do too. Now you do too. What is this? Okay, go ahead. No, that's fine. That's fine. We got all day.
I mean, I don't have to. I just, you know how obsessed I am with frickin' Equifax.
The
story.
But what's your...
It's just the story that never fails to enrage me. And although this week we are now distracted by the members of the Chinese military who have been arrested for doing the hacking, and that's a huge deal, and there's a lot of international intrigue, and now we're like, we can all be mad at China. And I loved this piece by Charlie Warzel in the New York Times where he argued, like, nope, we still need to be mad at Equifax and we still need to be mad at Congress. No company should have the absolute right to gather the amount of data about citizens that Equifax does with no way to opt out. There is no way for us to opt out of the credit reporting system. They're essentially the world's largest data broker, and they have the security of like a tent in the backyard.
Did you see the thing in the filing? Apparently they had some like universal access system that they were using to get into all this data, and the user ID was admin and the password was admin?
Yeah, dude. Yes.
Come on, man.
It's literally like a tent. Yeah. Like you just go, you push it over, you grab all the stuff in there. I mean, give me a break. It's not even a tent with a floor. It's like a yurt protecting the data of like bajillions of Americans that we can't get out.
Come on back. Come on back into the podcast. Come on back.
Okay, I'm done. It's like if you put a cup over a spider and you flick the cup over with your finger and the spider runs out.
That's it for the news fix. But you can get more news highlights, recommendations every Friday in our newsletter. Erica Phillips writes it. Sign up marketplace.org/newsletters.
Metaphors galore in the newsletter. let's let you guys talk for a while.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Amen, my brother. So last week we talked about the Internet of Things, and of course it wouldn't be this podcast if we didn't talk about all the ways things could go wrong. Data harvesting, hacking, take your pick. Wayne Spear wrote this comment in the Make Me Smart Facebook group. He says, while listening to episode 148, Internet of Things, it reminded me of this guy who hacked or fooled Google Maps by walking down a street in Berlin, pulling a wagon carrying 99 smartphones, all running Google Maps. Google thought they were all cars and marked the street red, which would show up as a traffic jam and at least theoretically cause cars to get routed to other streets. Probably can't begin to imagine all the ways an IoT could get hacked. That is true. I love that.
That is
Isn't that great?
Amazing.
Yeah.
And apparently that guy was an artist.
Yes.
And it was like a bit, yeah. Mm-hmm. There was a great, I never looked at LinkedIn, but I was looking at LinkedIn yesterday, and there was, and apparently people post funny stuff on LinkedIn, like a little baby Facebook.
Why?
Who knew?
Why?
Work-related stuff. They post articles.
God,
and
people are
But there was this like delightful cartoon, New Yorker style cartoon, and it had a bunch of people in a boardroom saying, why can't we use artificial intelligence to improve our sales funnel? And then an echo next to them on a table says, I can help you find articles about artificial intelligence. And this is exactly that. It can still be fooled, let alone hacked, which is a whole other creepy conversation. Here's a fight we can't stop picking. The week before last, we did... The episode about veganism that I referenced a minute ago, and I brought up this new subculture of what we are now calling swole vegans, which if that is not a Facebook group or a subreddit by now, it ought to be.
Yes.
And what we mean is weightlifters and bodybuilders who are giving up meat. And I mentioned the Game Changers documentary, God help me. And then we got a bunch of trainers and people saying that's not real.
Oh, my God.
And now we have a comment from a swole vegan, athlete and weightlifter Alex Skajowski, and here's what he sent in.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Alex from Austin, Texas. I'm a long-distance backpacker and mountaineer that lifts weights and goes long-distance running in the off-season. I started my plant-based diet transition by cutting out dairy because it was making me really sick. This included the whey protein powder that's the most common among weightlifters. I switched to a plant-based protein powder, and in doing so, was introduced to the subculture of vegan and vegetarian weightlifting. I definitely felt a lot healthier, stronger, and faster once I had cut out dairy. I cut out the land-based meats, and then finally, after watching Game Changers, cut out fish. I've been vegan for about a year and have never felt better. My fellow athlete friends definitely like to poke fun at my eating habits. I've been called a soy boy before, but the most common response that I get is disbelief. They really can't believe that I could get as big as I am while only eating plants. Thank you so much for your interest in this topic, and have a great day.
I'm going to need a picture, man. How big are you on
I mean,
on
we
plants?
Need photos. Come on.
I mean, no, look. Honestly, I think it's kind of amazing this works. I follow a photographer on Instagram. His name is Chris Burkhart. He's like an outdoor athlete, landscape photographer, but also like a marathon bicyclist and extreme skier and all kinds of stuff. Not swole, but does these long-distance endurance sports. He's a vegan. And I just think it's really interesting. So, you know, the body adapts, right? The body does what it does.
It doesn't. Look, everybody's body is different. I think that may be part of it. Like, we know that this is a controversial conversation. We also know that people have different things that work for them. And it's very possible that what works for somebody's body doesn't work for somebody else's body. And there's some science into that. And we're not necessarily trying to come down either way. But I really appreciate that we are getting to offer all of these different viewpoints. And also, I also would like to see the swole picture.
For sure.
I mean, come on.
I mean, you can't say you can't get as big as I am.
Prove it, buddy.
You know, right? Come on, man. How much do you bench, yo? All right. Anyway, here's another point of view.
Do you even lift, bro?
Here's Bill Denny with his take on this whole thing.
Hi, this is Bill Denny from Elkton, Maryland. Thanks for your report on the harm to our food system and our climate caused by modern agricultural practices. I agree that the focus should be on restoring or regenerating our soil. However, encouraging people to give up meat is the wrong approach. The best way to restore soil health and sequester carbon in the soil is through intensive rotational grazing of animals on pasture. Grazing animals for short bursts builds the diversity of grassland plants, spreads nutrients, and builds the soil's water-carrying capacity. Farmers can tie grazing into cover cropping of production fields on diversified farms to make their fields more productive. Grass-fed beef is healthy, it supports carbon sequestration, and is a critical component of feeding the soil. Thanks for making us smarter.
Well, thank you, Bill. I hadn't really thought that one through. I had also not really considered the whole carbon sequestration part of this, actually, which, when you get to it, is a tad fundamental, but interesting thoughts.
Yeah. I mean, I think this gets to almost a weird version of exactly what we talked about with Jerry, which is like there are so many downstream impacts of every action. And we have to start thinking about everything in a more holistic way. And some of that does include not making rules for everyone.
Yeah.
And, you know, or considering the impact of those rules.
Totally.
I think we're about done with the swole vegan topic. Just FYI, my two cents there.
Yep.
But thank you for all of your smart thoughts, because I agree with all of you. We will end, as always, on the Make Me Smart question. This time it comes from Susan in Wisconsin.
Hi, Molly. Hi, Kai. This is Sue in Madison, Wisconsin, with a really silly things I thought I knew. I have been so enjoying listening to you credit your sound engineer for years, and I was hearing Bent Holiday, as opposed, for example, to a straight holiday. And being queer, I thought that was pretty awesome as a handle.
Oh,
and then
man.
Recently you were singing his praises at the end of your broadcast, and I realized it's Ben Holiday. There you go. Something I thought I knew. Love your show every week.
I mean,
thank you guys.
I love our show every week too. That's the most amazing thing.
Love you too, Sue. Ben, I should tell you, is on leave for a couple of months. He's working on a music project that he's got going, but we will absolutely send this to him and he will get a kick out of it.
And I feel like somewhere Bent is a thing in the Australian vernacular too, which Ben is. Bent Holiday, also a great t-shirt. I mean, like the tally of t-shirts. Is really
the swag.
Maybe you should
itself.
Switch from knitting to embroidering. You could just embroider t-shirts during every episode.
I could.
That is all for this week's podcast. For obvious reasons, we're going to just stop talking now.
Oh, my God.
But don't forget, you get daily explainers on your smart speaker covering all manner of topics from prohibition to electric eels.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. Did you do the electric eels one or did I? Must have been you.
I assume I'm about to. That's my guess.
Ah, the cold read.
Just
anyway.
Tell your Echo device to make me smart and listen. It's actually pretty magical, you guys. Yeah, I don't know if you've used this skill, but it's really fun.
It is kind of cool. We're just waiting. Hang on. Hold it. Wait.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. Thanks to our video producer, Ben Hethcote, and our intern, Ethan Peretz, who I got to meet in person today. And thanks to our writer-producer, Erica Phillips.
This week's program was engineered by Drew Jostad. Our theme music was composed by Bent Holiday and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. And we are out of here. Bent Holiday. I love that.
Bent Holiday.
Get bent, right? There's that.
That's not as nice, though.
No?
All right. Can't believe you would say that and not let me say
What was that? You can't do that. And in the fading seconds, the E.
The E comes riding over the horizon.
Oh, yeah. Of course I'm on the line.
Come it's on. All good.
Who doesn't love a good Ferris Bueller reference? Come on, man.
Precisamente.
Right? Exactly. Exactly.
Or an opening curse. God.
That's right. Well, there's that, too. Jerry, how are you? It's Kai Rizdahl in Los Angeles.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.